All right, missed my introduction. The session will go for the next 10 minutes or so, and the introduction I'll give is that we have me and Gabe Sloan sitting here discussing ministry and the landmines that we sometimes face in ministry. So we're just going to have a conversation, be point blank and to the point of how we deal with things, and hope this is beneficial for those who are listening. So here it goes. The issues that we have had in ministry are for our good, are for our benefit, are for building us up, are for strengthening us, and we believe that by God, because God's the one who allows those things in our life for us to go through struggles and go through pains. And I would challenge all of us, everyone, to think of this, is that there has never been a time, if you can think back, that you've spiritually grown that hasn't been through a hard time. We don't grow any other way. And this is God using these things to cause us to grow. He works all these things for good. He takes all the things that are meant for destruction and destroying us and turns them around and can restore those things and cause good for us. And many things that we struggle with, even from staff issues that we many times go through, we have a lot of things to lead and a lot of people to lead. And part of that is a staff that we work with. The other things that we have to struggle with are even just our own families. And being married, you have, kids yet? No kids yet. I've got two kids. 2 days, I'll have a 6 and a 7-year-old. My youngest will be 6 years old. And so the struggles that come with not only kids, but with leading a wife and leading a home, in the midst of trying to lead ministry, which can be very taxing. Then you also have just the basics of working in a work environment. And I would say one of our struggles that's been at Shively has been our salary and hourly employee kind of thing. Do you have secretaries and folks that are hourly and punch in and do the...
Yeah, they don't punch in. Our secretary is actually salary.
Salary as well. Wow, cool. I'd be interested to hear how that works. Because ours are hourly, and you get those tensions that exist. We'll talk about some of those. And then the just the pay grade that comes as a youth minister many times in comparison to others. And I was encouraged by hearing Wayne Rice say one of his goals was to gain respect and be seen as a professional. And I think we're slowly coming that way, but haven't been seen completely that way yet. And working with the teenagers in some churches becomes you entertain the kids while we do the things with adults, and we don't want them messing up our thing, and so you go entertain them. So yeah, you get salary paid and being seen as the guy who just entertains the kids, and all those things can easily put you at a I'm done, I'm defensive, I'm not going to do this. And many times we come to, this isn't worth it even, and why, we struggle through those kind of thoughts because all those things seem to be, I'm not respected, I've got staff issues, I've got people who judge me based on my salary versus hourly employee, and you're not in the office and I am, and I have to show up and you don't, and those tensions that exist within our setting. And again, a wife who says you love your kids more than you love ours, and those kind of things come across and are hard to deal with, and they can become a stumbling block for you, and you do have to find the balance in there. The things that that you deal with as dealing, and I've got a list of the the people who we lead, and many times we realize that church, home, and self are three plates in themselves to keep spinning, and just dealing with a job let alone dealing with ministry, that's your job, dealing with a home, but dealing with it in such a way that's honoring to God, that you don't just survive like many, but you flourish like people expect you to in ministry. Your family is the example of what other people are looking towards. And then, of course, yourself, which is a trick in itself. You've got three enemies, and one of them is yourself. And the enemy is the devil, and the enemy is the world. And when you're battling all these things, without balancing these things in Christ and the Word, and understanding that if you don't live in righteousness, no one else is going to care, in a sense, in the world. But the church cares above and beyond. And sometimes the church can be the ones who lower that standard of righteousness and say, let's just do the easiest practice and get away with whatever we can, and staff can do that too. And I've seen that even with our own staff dealing with a first, and there's many things that go through here, but a first pastor that I had was pretty much don't break anything, and don't let anybody do bad things to our students. Everything else is okay, whatever you do, make sure it's good. And I wouldn't say that was his only thing, but that was what he communicated to me. And didn't have a relationship with him where I could chat with him, hang out in his office, talk with him about struggles. It was a very standoffish, doing my own thing. Sadly, it was a, I'd say this in just a gently, and I've said it many times and felt arrogant as I say this, but I'll say it this way. The pastor had churches that he led before he came to Shively that were smaller than the youth group that I was leading at the time when this happened. And so managing the workers and managing my intern and managing all those things, I realized was a hard task. And so I don't fault him and say, well, look, he didn't even do this. He was stepping from 80 to 650 in a congregation with no staff, not even a secretary, to not only his own secretary, but three other secretaries and four other staff members. So tough situation to be in. And again, I don't fault him. Don't say there's no way it was a bad thing in a sense. And yet there's the difficulties that come through that. The main one, and I talk about this to many guys, is that in Boyce College, and many of the guys who are pastors that have walked with me through that encouraged me many times, not only in the initially coming to Boyce and calling to Boyce, if you're not called to ministry, then don't do this. And that was a good challenge. At first, it was kind of like, man, don't seem like they want people here. But it was the honest and the good thing to examine my heart in, because what happened through all these years is I've realized, man, that the calling is the only thing that's kept me there sometimes. Nothing else has. No flair and glitz and no things that are well done, no things that are bad that need fixing, that I like fixing things. I mean, none of these things have kept me in this ministry other than God's calling, and I know He's called me to it. So, and I'll go over, and I'm not going to go over them all here, but the affirmation of my calling is one. Keep my focus on my mission is the other, and my mission in our church has definitely been reflected more in what we find in Corinthians, which was divisions exist among you. Some of you say I'm of this, some of you say I'm this, and we had pastors camps in our own church, and I'm of this guy, and aren't you picking a side, and don't you see his point, and don't you, and because of all that, I stood up in a, after our senior pastor left and our associate pastor was going to get pushed out the door by the personnel, one of the guys on the personnel committee, I had to stand up and say, look, I'm telling you, clear conscious as I can, I'm not of this guy, but what you're doing to this guy is wrong. Because, for one, this isn't what we should do biblically. For two, the man has not done the things that you're accusing him of. And for three, this is what Satan is using to destroy our church. And so, go about this a different way, maybe, but what you're doing is destroying the church. So, all the keeping the focus of the mission, you know, Mike, you know, Mark Elliott, Don Chuan as well. I said, look, guys, man, we got to keep to what God's called us here. And whatever all this junk around us is going on, know that we're going to be able to influence a little, but we're not going to be able to be change agents maybe in some of these areas, because we're not seen as the pastor kind of guy. We're just a kid that entertains the youth, whatever, and keeps them out of trouble. We're also not going to be seen as professionals in the area of running the church, and I'm not. This is my first new church and first position in the church. But all that to say, keep to the calling. What's your calling? It's getting the gospel into students' lives. It's continuing to fight the good fight. It's continuing to lead yourself in the right way. And if you get caught up in it, you're going to be a part of it instead of remaining unstained from this. And it fell through. All of it did. And a pastor left, pastor left, pastor left. And then, of course, I'm left alone with a children's minister who had just been there a year. And that children's minister, as soon as our new pastor gets on, is immediately let go. And I'm the lone man standing.
Wow.
So, then he and I are the ones running Lincoln Arms together and running. And this is the other landmine that can come in this. Love the guy, love the working with him, love his heart in ministry. He's brand new into ministry, though. He's fresh out of seminary. He's 46, 47. Got kids, one in sixth grade, one in eighth grade, one in ninth grade, and then one just going into first grade. So all those age ranges. And so, of course, again, here's my ministry getting evaluated by pastor's kids, which, yeah, which is good and bad at times. So, and you got to watch out for those things. Not that I would do ministry any differently, and I don't do any ministry any differently for pastor's kids than I do any other kids. And I don't put it on differently because I know that, you know, big man's watching because there are students in here. And yet, you know, those can become landmines. Knowing too that you're the one responsible for your pastor's kid to walk through this in the right way is a challenge. And yet, my associate pastor's kids never want to step foot in a church again after going through all the disunity and things that they went through. His wife wanted to get away from it as well. So that's the kind of fire that comes. And mentioning his wife, I'll go on to the next one. It's just affirmation of my wife and giving my wife, we coined it, whatever, we said it was a white flag. At any time that you say, I can't do this, I can't do ministry, I can't do I can't do ministry in this context, in this place, I am completely spent, and I never, ever want to step foot in a church again. I said, if you get to that point and you haven't told me, then I'm going to lay that on you, that you didn't tell me soon enough. I can't do this anymore. And I had someone challenge me with this. They said, I don't think Moses ever, you know, gave his wife the, you know, God's called me, but if you ever tell me I'm not. And I didn't put it in that way, I don't think. I put it in this way, that if Moses' wife would have said, you're spending too much time with the people and you're completely neglecting the family, then there's balance that's got to come there. I didn't say I'd walk out of ministry. I said, I walk out of this context. God's clearly called us to ministry. But what my wife said, she said, I didn't get any kind of, I'm in control now. I can tell him when to go in and out of ministry. What I got is a confidence that he loves me.
Yeah, more than the job.
More than this particular ministry. Mm-hmm. He loves me more than this. And at any time, she said, that gave me the confidence to go through this with a comfort, a peace, didn't make it easier because we're still going through crazy stuff, but it made me go through this with he does have my best interest looked out for me. And he is looking for me as his precious bride still, that he would give himself for. And even what he's created and designed and loves and pours himself into and working with these teenagers is life. It is what God's called me to. So it's what my heart beats with. And it's not exactly her calling. She is great with working with teenagers. And I'll say this off record, it's just like cooking. She doesn't like cooking, but man, when she cooks, she's good. She does some awesome, awesome stuff. Yeah. She doesn't like doing ministry in that sense. It's not her heartbeat. But when she does and she works with teenagers and gives them wisdom and encouragement, it's the affirmation that when God said, Phil, you need to look for the woman who I could walk alongside of in ministry, and know that at any point in time that you'd say, I'm sorry, I can't minister to you. You're a female. I can't do those kind of settings. You need to go pour your heart out to someone. And that's the one that I would trust, that she's going to give that kind of advice. She's going to love on you and give you as much wisdom, if not more, which he really is more wise than I ever wished to be or could be. She has that kind of wisdom that she'd give to those teenage girls. That's the kind of person that she is. So affirming her and continuing to encourage her in that has been one thing that could be a major. And I saw pastor's wife, couple of them, say, I'm not doing this anymore. And you're not doing this anymore. And one of them left out of that bitterness. And sadly, I don't think he ever gave her the, hey, you've got the opportunity to say, we can't do this anymore. And give her the strength and the empowerment to go ahead and work within that. It was he let it go as far as it would, and she finally said, I'm done, get me out of here, or I'm leaving. So, that you shouldn't get there.
Yes.
Shouldn't get there. And then it just comes down to the next one is pleasing God and not man. Because there's a whole lot of things that you're going to say, that's the way that you should work with this teenager. That's what you should counsel this parent as. That's how you should interact with your pastor. That's what you should do as you preach. It's not, throw that scorecard out. And not to say that we don't seek wisdom from man, because that's what God's put us in a common community for. But I'm not here to please man. I'm here to please God. And that was Paul's statement throughout. That was in the initial part of Acts, as you see these Christians say, we're not about doing what the legalistic Jews are wanting us to do. We're about what God's called us to do. And here's what he's called us to do, is preach a gospel of grace that is walking in the Spirit and not by the law. So, and then Paul says in Galatians, what am I doing then? Pleasing God or man? Because if I was pleasing man, and he lists out all the things that he would do, this is how I would act. But it's
everybody
not. Yeah, exactly. And everybody would be happy. Yeah, which your ministry tends to be sometimes, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's really funny. I train, fight, like MMA,
mm-hmm.
that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys I train with, he was like, I think ministry is just a big scam. And one other guy said, yeah, it is. You know, he's like, I think it's just a big scam, too. You know, they just do it for the money. And
we're going to fight right now.
Yeah, I was like, all right, we already sparred. But no, I looked at him, and he's, you know, a very callous individual. He's a pagan of pagans in his lifestyle, but he's actually was baptized in a Methodist church, and his parents and him are members of a Baptist church. I worked at a Baptist church.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I don't know about you, and I don't know your situation. He's like, but Pastor Joe, I'm assuming that's his home pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Pastor Joe in Mount Sterling makes 50 grand a year, and he lives a comfortable life. And I thought about it. I was like, that is horribly scary. And I've been thinking about it ever since. That is such an easy temptation to get into, because there's so much stuff that I could do.
Yeah.
Like, I could draw a crowd.
Sure.
I could get people in the church to rally behind me and applaud me.
Mm-hmm.
And do those things and be like, you know, Paul and the entire New Testament warns of, hey, you know what? The false prophets, Israel loved them.
Yeah.
You know what they did to the one, you know what they did to the prophets? They killed them.
Yeah.
And so that's been a huge, and I'm actually going to start teaching through Galatians to the youth.
Awesome.
And so I've really been studying that as he said that and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And that's where Paul says, you know, am I pleasing God or am I pleasing
yeah.
man?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
man, it is, and I say that as a huge pitfall because it's like, man, you know, ministry can be easy. And mm-hmm. the people at that gym that fight, the ones that have never stepped in a church in their life, or the ones like him that are complete hypocrites, who, you know, they're a member of the church, but they haven't been in 15 years.
Right.
And
it's amazing how those people who aren't really walking and doing and living out the church life end up saying, yeah, this is what's wrong and what you should do. And I'm not in there doing anything about it, but, and that can become that pitfall for you as well of the, well, see what's wrong with the pastor and see what's wrong with these parents and see what's wrong with these. And you're not living their life. You're not living what they're going through. And that can easily become a, I'm justified, I'm better than, I should have what they have. I mean, it's a ploy, man. It is. It's Satan's little ploy to...
You constantly got to be watching your heart. I was telling, Zach Thurman and I and a couple other guys. I know, Greg Gibson and there's several other people that are really close friends of mine that we just have this list of accountability questions. And at any time, we can call, day, night, whatever, call, text, email, Facebook, tweet one of these questions, and there's a required, it's basically like we've had an agreement.
What's your line?
As ASAP. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the biggest temptations for me is, working with people that are spiritually immature or absolutely inept.
Mm-hmm.
They're not Christians at all.
Yeah.
I'm convinced that a lot of people that are, that belong to the church that I work at are just not believers.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest struggle, sin-wise, is not sexual sin, is not, just like basic sins, I guess you could say, like common sins.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest thing is to not look at these people and think that I'm better than them.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the devil to deceive me and say, man, you've got it all together spiritually.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
look at you,
what you're doing. I mean, you read your Bible all the time. And these people probably don't even own a Bible. You know what I'm saying? Like, and they're the ones like...
They couldn't find their Bible if they wanted to.
Yeah, these stupid people are the ones that are trying to run the church, or pull the rug out from under you. And man, you just... God, they're stupid.
Yeah.
And can you believe that? And just constantly this attitude of judging them as if my heart is not as... wickedly sinful.
Yeah.
And I have to constantly remind myself and confess my sin to those guys and say, I'm tempted with this. And oftentimes I give into that mindset and that's my biggest struggle. And I have to just come back and remind myself, the only reason that I know what I know is because what God has shown me.
That's right.
Like, I wasn't a believer until I was 18. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't, I was like, right before
you
were graduated,
did you grow up in church?
Ish. I mean, I'm from a town of 3,000 people, so.
Gotcha.
I mean, everybody kind of went to church, but once I got old enough to kind of avoid it, I would always spend the night at a friend's house that I knew wouldn't go to church on Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would act like I would wake up in the morning and then go back to bed.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom passed away when I was really little. And she was a believer, and she also took us to church.
Gotcha.
And I specifically remember being 9 years old and saying this in my head and making it, is I had set goals for myself, and one of the goals that I had set is I was going to accomplish all of my goals, a part that had anything to do with Jesus. But I associated myself culturally.
And sure.
I got to the point where I was a senior in high school, and I achieved every one of my goals, and I was miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely miserable. And then a couple of my really good friends that I used to sin with all the time actually became Christians.
Wow.
And started sharing the gospel with me for like 6 months.
Wow.
And then like February, right before I graduated, God saved me.
Yeah.
Cool. All these people like praying for me and ministering to me. And so for me, and I think that's a weird thing in our churches, these people show up and they come to church, and I'm thinking, before I was a Christian, I didn't want to be in church.
Yeah.
Why would I wake up on a Sunday morning
when
I had been out drinking or I'd been out like you know, doing whatever mm-hmm. on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to get up and cause, like, so it's really hard for me to relate in the sense of when I wasn't a believer, I mm-hmm. didn't want to be in church. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why people who aren't believers want to be in church.
Yeah.
And, like, run things. Like, it's beyond me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. But, you know, your testimony is kind of similar because yeah. I know we've talked before. You didn't become a Christian until later, right?
Oh, I grew up in the church. My dad was actually a pastor of a really small church when I was four or five, whatever. I remember heading to church one day in the back of our little Ford Fairmont. And I remember leaning up and asking my parents about, you know, what it is to get to heaven, what I needed to do to get to heaven. And of course, you know, they would have told me the gospel and being good and those things that I should do. And I remember thinking, I don't want to go to hell. I want to go to heaven. And then again at like seven, I was at a backyard Bible club kind of thing, you know, very, very young. And there were some things that I had done that I knew those were bad things. I shouldn't have done those. And I didn't even confess those or tell my parents about them. But I knew that I needed Jesus, and this guy was telling me this is the way to get this. And again said, you know, I need to give my life to Jesus. This is wrong. It was then in middle school that I began to get involved in drugs and smoking and those kind of things. And I hid it as best I could kind of thing. And then, of course, into high school, really got involved in alcohol and pot. And, of course, you know, smoking was a habit by then, and I didn't break it until I was 21. And when I was 21, finally, that I realized, sitting at a church meeting down in Austin, Texas, it was called Austin Metro, I heard for the first time what I believe was the gospel penetrating my heart about a relationship with Christ that would set me free from my sins and set me in a path that I knew I should have been on, but didn't walk in. Believed in God, believed that I was a Christian, would say that all through my high school years, was a good guy kind of thing. You know, I wasn't really, really mean or beating people up or hurtful or any of that way that the world would deem me. And many of my old friends would be like, you know, you're always a good guy. What do you mean you become a good guy? You know, what do you mean you become a Christian now? I said, man, I'm free from my sin. I no longer have to live like that. And it wasn't until, four or five years ago, that then I heard a message on grace that was this environment of grace that I could walk in and live in, and that it wasn't about legalistically doing a bunch of things in order to be right before God. And I would never have said it that way. I'd always say that it wasn't about being good that would get you to heaven. But once I was saved, then I needed to be good. Then I needed to do what was right. And I messed up some things and struggled through some things that, you know, then I'm going, man, I'm a Christian and I still do these things. And I didn't really have the clearest answer. And of course, you know, I'm in a ministry by here and wouldn't at all say I was legalistically teaching my kids how to be better. But there was a whole lot of me saying, you better straighten up and you better start living right. And, you know, still would say sin's destructive. It's gonna harm you. There's consequences that you're going to live with forever because of this. I have those consequences in my life. Don't live like that. And then, you know, understanding that church, for me as a kid, it was about getting drugged to church every time my parents went and did stuff. And then by the time I was 21, 22, I'm going to church four nights a week because I wanted to go to Austin Metro, which was a Tuesday night Bible study for singles. I wanted to go to a Bible study on experiencing God and the mind of Christ and these kind of things. And I was going on another night of the week. And then we'd have a men's Bible study of a bunch of us guys, and we'd do Bible study together. And of course, Sunday activities. And every Saturday there was something going on with the college group. I was there. So kind of crazy changeover from me running from church to me wanting to be around people all the time. And I would say that difference is what I can't create in a student. You can't create. We can't create that in a student. That's God changing their heart. It was God changing Gabe. It was him making you go, I want this. And that's I mean, in essence, that's what Ezekiel 36 is talking about, the promise to Abraham saying, I'm going to put a new heart, a heart of flesh in them. They're going to desire to walk in my ways. They're going to desire to do what I tell them to. And I kind of stumbled across this looking through Galatians once and this promise to Abraham that was given. And this is what it was. This was the problem that the Jews had. They had a problem saying, you know, you're not going to tell these people the law and tell them to buck up and tell them to get right. They're just going to live in sin. And someone said it really aptly the other day. You can either live or take advantage of grace and live in a way that takes advantage of grace as a legalistic person or as a person who's really liberal in your sin. So really, what's that come down to? As Romans 5 says, the law came in so that transgression would increase. That's kind of dangerous to preach, especially as Paul was saying. And what's going to happen there is that people are going to say, you're preaching that cheap grace stuff, man. You're preaching them that they can live in any way they want, and God still forgives them. And yes, that's the truth. That is what will happen. And he says, but what should we do?
Should we sin so the grace should
so the grace may abound? May it never be. I love the statement this guy gave me the other day in a message I was listening to. He said, you know, that's like saying we got plenty of gauze and Band-Aids. Let's just go around hitting each other with shovels. I mean, really, it's fine. We'll fix ourselves. You jump off this building. You only break a leg. I mean, how foolish is that? And when we teach our students and we walk with these people who don't understand what the true gospel is, that it's a gospel of freedom from the law and walking by the Spirit. And that's tough to preach. Because then you got to say, you got to walk by the Spirit. But what happens in this is freedom comes in. And now I'm walking by the Spirit and I'm putting to death the deeds of the flesh. That's what's naturally going to happen. John 15:14, I think it is. Or 14:15. I always get those confused. But he says, I think it's 14:15. He says, if you love me, you will. Now come in. This is what's going to happen from you. This will be true of you. And not that we judge those who are in the church. You know, I'm not a judge, especially as Paul says, I'm not a judge for those outside the church. But we are for those inside the church to see that they're in the faith. And by your fruits, you're going to know these things. But our goal in this whole thing and discipline that Christ talks about, that Paul talks about there in Corinth, says this goal is to get them to walk with Christ. And if they refuse to walk with Christ, if they refuse to acknowledge your sin and turn from those things, then you have nothing to do with them. Don't even eat with such a one who would continue on in these kind of things, because they're not true brothers. They're not ones following the faith. And you're going to see these things. We don't want to say that in today's church. Even the church that I work in. And we want people, right? Yeah. So any of them come. You don't see that in the New Testament church. They believed, they were baptized, and they were added to their number, not the just everybody show up. Now, of course, you got to balance that out. Paul says to Timothy, even there's guys that are destructive. They're coming in to teach heresy. They're coming in to teach destructive ways. This is who's going to infiltrate the church. They're wolves in sheep clothing. I don't know how many we have now. I mean, when your pack looks more like wolves than it does sheep, that's when we realize, oh, our persecution, and this can become, again, turn it back towards this landmine thing, it can become our temptation to try and pick out the wheat and the tare. And he says, let them grow up together. I'll destroy the tare in time. And what you're going to do by tearing up the tare is you're going to destroy the wheat. So be careful. Yeah, be careful how you do those things. And all that to say, you can gain as many people as you want to and bring them into the church. But it's for us to gather around. Ephesians 4:11-13, that they've been going over a couple of times, it's to equip the saints to the work of the ministry. So if we've got a big old church full of people who aren't saints, then we're not equipping anybody. We're not doing anything with those people, but teaching them a bunch of morals and what they should live. And then this is the toughest thing, that our pastor, one of the things that sunk him is he wanted to preach every Sunday morning the gospel. It was for the lost people. And then people didn't show up to Sunday night church. There was somewhat Sunday school discipleship going on, but there was nothing else for depth going on for our people. Then what do you have? You have no depth. You have no meat. You've only got milk. There's a balance that's got to come there. And the seeker-sensitive thing's kind of been squashed finally. People said, stop doing that. That wasn't the best idea. We got a bunch of lost people in here and tried to treat them like Christians, and it doesn't work.
Yeah,
because we wanted a bunch of people. Mm-hmm.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's definitely wild. It's funny you talk about your testimony. Mine's pretty similar. I actually, as my mom was dying, she was dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually professed faith and was baptized because I thought, in a 9-year-old's brain.
Sure.
My mom was dying. She's a Christian. She prays. I become a Christian, then I can pray.
Mm.
So that's what led to a lot of the,
wow,
not satisfaction with the churches. I prayed the prayer because they told me to.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I had to be baptized, so they baptized me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was a Christian. And then when my mom died, I was callous about it all. And so it's really one of those things. I was, in your testimony, I can see a lot of mine as well. I was a good guy. Like, one of my goals when I was a 9-year-old that I set after my mom passed away was, I wanted to be the golden boy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be the guy that everybody wanted their kids to be like. And I wanted to be, to my friends, the guy that everybody wanted to hang out with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was out drinking, partying, drunkenness every weekend, doing crazy stuff, and my friends thought I was awesome.
Yeah.
And I was one of the most popular guys in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I was starting quarterback for the football team, all that jazz, and then the parents, nobody had any clue.
Sure.
They had no idea that mm-hmm. I was involved in the stuff that I was involved in and that I was mm-hmm. doing. Until I became a Christian and, confessed that to my dad.
Yeah.
And to my grandparents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in all that stuff, and it's really funny. I'll never forget when I felt like I had arrived when I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I went for a scholarship interview,
mm-hmm.
and there was valedictorians, salutatorians, and I had my reputation essentially coming in there. I was not the salutatorian, valedictorian,
yeah.
or anything like that.
Yeah.
One of the people that was actually interviewed for this just got her PhD from Vandy.
Wow.
Is the people that I was interviewing against for this scholarship.
Yeah.
And I walked in there, totally just schmoozed these old women, and got the scholarship over everybody else.
Wow.
And she tried to hook me up with her daughter. Because of the reputation I had.
Yeah.
And I had achieved the ultimate type of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Because I was a good person, because everything, and I appeared to have everything. And,
but bro, because
and then it's like I had all that stuff, and I'll never forget. And people called me a Christian because
mm-hmm. Sure.
I was baptized on it,
sure.
and so everybody treated me as a
Christian. Good kid.
And I remember going to bed every night, scared to death that I was going to die.
Yeah.
And I remember praying, "Now I lay me down to sleep." That's
yeah.
the only prayer I knew.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing I knew. And then when God saved me, I'll never forget. I was like you. All of a sudden, I was like, I was in my pastor's office every
yeah.
day.
Oh,
asking
man.
All these questions. Yeah. It was like, give me this book, give me this. And
yeah.
I was just like reading it
yeah.
and all this stuff. And I'd read like 2 books before I became a Christian.
Mm-hmm. I had 0.
Yeah. I'd read 2 books, and one was on 2 basketball players, and the other was a book about sharks. And that was outside of school. That's all I ever read.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, God saved me. And I'll never forget the first youth service that I ever went to. And mm-hmm. I always try to remind myself of this,
mm-hmm.
Where I came from.
I showed up
to the first youth service. And when I have other kids come in that are visitors and stuff, he said, turn to First John. I pick up a pew Bible, because the only Bible I had was my mom, when she died, gave me her Bible.
Yeah.
And it was in King James.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the heck is this?
I don't get that.
So I didn't even take it
to
the first service that I went to. And he said, turn to 1 John. And I open up the Bible, and I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
Sure.
Because I've been called a Christian my whole life.
Yeah.
And
he said, 1 John 2.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
But I open up the Bible, and I just start flipping. And I'm like looking at the... I go to the 1 John that I see, which is the Gospel of
John.
And he starts reading.
You're like,
and
man.
Everybody else is following along. Like, they're reading it too. And I was like, what kind of Bible? I'm like, is this church heretical? And then all of a sudden, I'm like looking at mine and like my brain. Like, I feel like my palms are getting sweaty. I'm getting nervous.
Yeah.
Because somebody's going to find me out. And I'm trying to, like, okay, maybe he said three. And then I look over and I see, like, there's a number.
A number one.
In front of this girl that's beside me. And I was like, there's a John and a first John. And so, you know, I was totally the same way. And just all the hypocrisy and stuff. And so I have to remind myself of that when dealing with a church like what I work at now, where a lot of people have been told they were Christians their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they're no more Christians than that Coke bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does a lot for my own personal sanctification my approach to dealing with them.
Yeah.
Because of how people dealt with me.
Yeah. Okay, so let's back up. You and I hang out in high school. Because we would have been buds. We'd have hung out. We'd have gotten drunk. We'd have gone to church. We'd have had all the old ladies fooled, is what I say in my testimony. They were good kid. Good kid. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. I mean, nice, polite, did whatever mom and dad asked. But I was in the back smoking, drinking, doing pot like crazy. Where's the youth pastor come in on this? The one time, I told my parents this last night, I said, the one time this youth pastor came into my life, he picked me up, took me out to breakfast one morning before school. Craziest thing. Nobody ever does that. I didn't like getting up anyway, but he takes me to breakfast. And he says, hey, man, I hear you've been smoking. You know that stuff's bad for you. You know that it's not good for you. And you know your parents know that you're doing it, right? Yeah. When are you going to stop doing that kind of stuff? I don't know. And for years, I said, last night I told my parents this. I said, I think maybe there's a ghost I'm chasing right there. Because I think that in my mindset of a youth pastor now, what I need to be is I need to be that relationship that if he would have hung out with me the second time and would have called me on that, I think that would have been a turning point in my life. Now, that's a hypothetical, a what if, you know, God had to come in my life. It wasn't just a man asking me about smoking. But that relationship was never there. That getting in my face and walking with me and being real with me and saying, I know you're dirty, bro. I know you're dirty. And you're doing stuff that's not good. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with that? You're there now.
Yeah.
You got the star football player and the guy that's cool in school, and you're going to go, bro, I want to knock your clock off, man, because you're putting on a show. I was you. Don't you see this? Because what gets to the students that I've come across with my testimony, they're like, cool, I can do what he did. I can do what I want, sow my wild oats, live for myself, and then I can go become good like him. At 18, I was almost killed. I should have been dead in the car accident that I was in because I was so drunk. The police officer said, the guy's still in the car, and I said, no, I'm sitting right here. He goes, no, you can't be the guy in the car. That guy's got to be dead. There's no way no one climbed out of that car. I climbed out of that car unscathed. That was a God thing at 18. It should have woken me up when I had to do drug rehab, when I had to go to the, pay the court fees, when I did all my alcohol rehab and all the DUIs that I now have because of all this. But it didn't. it didn't wake me up until God woke me up at 21 and finally realized, but do I just walk with these guys and let them walk in darkness? Is there an opportunity that I have to get into their lives now? How can I want to do that. I want to be the one who says, Phil, stop. You're going in a destructive way, man. You're killing yourself and you don't have to. And there's something better to live for. Because the kids who are the good kids in church, they were a bunch of nerds and goops and geeks. No one was cool. They weren't cool. And it wasn't, and sadly, and I'll put it this way, mic is on, whatever. There's people who are weird, and then there's people who are weird for Jesus. The kids that I went to school were both. They were both weird and weird for Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
And that's actually a lot of you. I have read that.
Mm-hmm.
It's they're social outcasts.
Right.
And a lot of them, the reason they're there.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't have anything else to do. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but you and I, both youth pastors, walk through this, the cool, the partying it up, the living my life. God calls me now. What in you and I, don't try and keep up this cool. Because you know what I do a lot of times? I keep up the cool. I sit back in my chair and I act all night. And some of it's just me doing what I do, but others is I got to be the cool guy because I don't want to come across as the geek and the dork and the, and then I start compromising sometimes. Yeah, Baptist crazy guys. I'm not like, you know, and I want to distance myself from the geek guys, from the not cool guys, because I want to be the cool guy still. I still struggle with those kind of things. But then I don't reach out to that kid who, he's a geek, he's a goofy kid, he's awkward, he's weird, I wouldn't want to be like you either, bro. I don't want to be the to save a life guy who steps up and says, hey, I'm the star quarterback, but I want to meet in the, you know, have you watched Save a Life? He said, hey, I want to meet in the commons at school every day and have lunch now that this is real for me. And you're going, that's not cool. Those things are cool for Jesus, but to everyone else, man, that's not cool. And you're in such, I know I'm rambling here, but I'm thinking through, then you're in such this pure, cool group that is not going to accept you. And that's fine if you're not accepting me because I'm following Christ. But those who I'm reaching for Christ. And that's cool if you don't accept me, if I'm not the cool kid in school because of those things. But will I really give that up? I want to be that kind of guy who reaches those kind of kids. That takes the star quarterback, that takes the, you know, the cool kids in school, the leaders, the ones who others are looking towards, and say, man, start living for Christ. Start living for what's right. Start being cool in this sense, because the rest of these guys, no one's listening to, no one's going to connect with, no one's...
Yeah, and I think one thing that I think about a lot of times, too, that's encouraging me is oftentimes, you know, you get through the, you know, what Paul says, you know, he'll use the weak things to shame the strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too often as youth pastors and as, I guess, in a professional approach to youth ministry, we view influence.
Yeah, we view the strong things.
We look at it and we look at Saul instead of David. Mm. And we say, man, Saul's big and he's tall and he has influence and the dude can fight and he's attractive and all these people pay attention to him. We should really go after Saul.
Yeah.
And we, like the nation of Israel, we're like, we want Saul, we want Saul, mm-hmm. we want a king.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy may be the, you know, the cool kid or the quarterback or the star basketball player or whatever. And meanwhile, you know, the foolish thing that God has chosen to shame the wise is sitting there. You know, the David, the small kid who mm-hmm. looks incapable of anything that mm-hmm. he says he may be able to do, whether he's
yeah.
killed a bear or not, he certainly can't kill the lion.
Yeah.
And so we look at the smaller, apparently weaker things of God. And so that's a big one for me because of my experience, and what happened is it was by coincidence. Or not coincidence. It was by God's providence that the people that became Christians and they actually had influence in my school. That influenced me,
mm-hmm.
There were good friends of me that became a believer, and then the gospel spread, and there were people who were, you know, nerdy and who were popular that all became Christians.
Yeah.
And all became friends.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It started with influencers, and so for me, that's another one of my temptations, to be like, hey, I need to attract a certain type of kid that will then do this, and then I have to think biblically.
Yeah.
That may not be where I need to be, and so
that's
the biggest thing for me. And I think so far as like influence of leaders, you know, the one thing that we have to, you know, that we look towards, I think that really helps is, and the kids that are living that dark life and walking in darkness, is we have to look at them and say, biblically, I was lucky to live as far as I did.
Yeah.
I almost drowned when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
I had a four-wheeler accident that is a freak thing that literally cannot be explained.
Yeah.
I was driving my four-wheeler when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And down a blacktop road, and the front brakes locked up for no reason.
Wow.
And threw me over the handlebars. I had a helmet on.
Wow.
And I turned my face like this.
Yeah.
The helmet hits the ground. The four-wheeler comes over the top of my head, and the back rack hits me in the back of the head against the blacktop and in the back.
Yeah.
And I just had this rush of adrenaline, and I jumped up with this 500-pound four-wheeler on my back.
Wow.
And stood up, and it looked like somebody like beat me across my back, and I took my helmet off, and it just crumbled. The insides of my helmet crumbled into pieces.
Wow.
A lot of the times I didn't grab the helmet off. And I think the emphasis that you have to put on those kids that are living in darkness and walking in darkness, that don't give up the coolness and the reputation and stuff like that, is, you know, Jesus doesn't guarantee tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the time for salvation is now.
Yeah.
And repentance is now.
Yeah.
It's because I'm not guaranteed to walk down the steps and not fall and break my neck and be dead.
Right.
Or, you know, have a tornado stir up outside and kill us both in here.
Mm.
And it's arrogance to assume that we'll live another day. And, you know, if the Lord is working on your heart, and if you're truly a believer, you need to stop. And if you're not a believer,
mm-hmm.
repent or perish, as Jesus says in Luke 13.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's never polite about it when he's talking to the Pharisees, like in Luke 13. He says, repent or perish.
Yeah.
And he's talking to him, and they ask all these questions. He's like, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because he talks about how the tower fell on those people,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of questioning God's justice and saying why. It's like when people try to explain why Katrina hit New Orleans.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, it's a sinful, wicked place.
Yeah.
It's like you're asking the wrong question.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be asking why those people. You should be asking, why not me?
Yeah.
Because we're all wickedly sinful, and we mm-hmm. deserve judgment mm-hmm. every breath we take. You, wicked sinner who's a nerd, and you, wicked sinner who's
a cool kid.
Cool kid,
yeah.
You need to ask, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
They're asking about, you know, and Jesus is mentioning the tower falling on these people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just walking.
Mm-hmm.
They might not have been doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
But they deserve that judgment.
Yeah.
And so when that's all in the context of the repent or perish. And I think I heard a good quote from a sermon a month or two ago. I don't even remember who said it. That said, our job as pastors is to settle the unsettled and unsettle the settled. Or to make comfortable the uncomfortable,
give comfort to those
to uncomfortable, and to make uncomfortable the comfortable. And so I think there's a balance in that, and how we approach it. And so that's my biggest thing is the people that are comfortable that are there with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't shake up their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
the radical kind of thing. I mean, the give it up for Christ, man. This is what he's calling us to do. Get out there and do this. That's what gets me the Yeah, I'm getting as complacent as the rest of them. I'm getting as complacent, and I mean this is all in this topic of landmines and speech kind of thing here. But it really comes down to, you know, God can place anything in my path to point me in the direction that He needs me to go, and I'm not going to question those things. I'm not going to say, did I deserve? Is He this? Is He? God has used this to shape me and mold me into who I am. And so I like that analogy there, the comfort to the those who are broken and hurting. And that's what Christ came to do, which is a lot of those people who are outcasts of society, those who are the dregs, those who don't need a doctor, right?
Yes.
It's those who need a doctor that I came for. And you all have your wisdom. You all have your flattery speech. You all have your knowledge. You don't need me, which is tough, because then you deal with those kids who are the smart kids that are going, science has proved all this. Why would I believe it? Why would I need this? That's not true. No, because you know that you're a sinner and condemned to die, and that you will suffer this judgment and punishment. How wise is that, bro?
Yeah, seriously.
That seems kind of foolish for you to go on living like that.